doing this is to tell you my own story, because I came up here to Oxford back in 1971 as an undergraduate at Wadham, and I was studying chemistry. And at that stage, I was an atheist, quite an aggressive atheist. Reading Richard Dawkins these days makes me all nostalgic, because, you know, I used to be like that too once. But I think one of the things I discovered at Oxford was that as I began to think about deep questions, I began to realize that my atheism actually wasn't very well grounded, that I'd kind of way simply assumed that atheism was right. I hadn't really thought about it in great detail. And to cut a very long story short, I abandoned atheism and embraced Christianity. What made me embrace Christianity? Well, I think there are several things, but for me the most important thing was this. That seemed to me to offer a big picture, a way of understanding the life, the world, which in effect held things together. It made sense of things. And that for me was very, very important. Here was a way of looking at science, at myself, at the world, which seemed really to make far more sense than anything else I was used to looking at. And many of you will know a quote from C.S. Lewis that I think makes this point very, very well. Lewis says, "I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else." In other words, Christianity gives you a lens which seems to bring things into focus. It gives you a map which seems to make sense of things. It, in effect, really equips you, I think, for engaging the world and making sense of it. And that was certainly my experience. And some of you will probably quite rightly point out that there is rather more to Christianity than simply making sense of things. Now, I want to agree with that, but, you know, we all have to start somewhere, and that's where I started, and I discovered kind of the deeper side of Christianity as I went along. But I want to hold on to that theme of making sense of things, because clearly, as a younger person, I believed that the natural sciences inclined you to atheism. In effect, a serious scientist, by definition, in effect, was also an atheist. And so I had to do a lot of thinking. How on earth could I take my new Christian faith and, in effect, reconcile it with my science? At that stage, as I was saying, I studied chemistry. I then went on to do a doctorate in molecular biophysics here in Oxford in the Department of Biochemistry. The bit of the department, by the way, which has now disappeared altogether. I was on the third floor of the building that used to be there and is now just kind of way an empty hole in the ground. What ways of making sense of the relation of science and faith did I come up with? What I want to do in this lecture is just talk you through some of the issues, some of the approaches that I found helpful, in the hope that this might also be helpful to some of you tonight. And then clearly, you know, if you feel I didn't talk about something that I should have, well, we've got plenty of time for Q&A, and I'm very happy just to pursue these in any way in which you like. So where should we begin? Well, let me begin with a quote from a man called William Inge, a professor of theology at Cambridge last century, who wrote these words, which I think amplify that quote I gave you from C.S. Lewis. Here's what he says. "Rationalism tries to find a place for God in its picture of the world. But God cannot be fitted into a diagram. He is rather the canvas on which the picture is painted, or the frame in which it is set." And what Inge is really trying to say is, look, God is not kind of way an extra item in the world, as if religious people believe everything an atheist believes and then just adds one more thing called God, which is like adding an extra chair to the seats here at St. Ebbs, you know, one more thing. It's much more about there being something deeper, something so important, something so rich, which, if it is true, then provides you with an explanation, a way of seeing things, a way of living, which actually changes everything. I think that's one of the points I find very difficult to grasp as an atheist. I tend to think of Christians as people who believed in God, and I just couldn't see why that was exciting or interesting or why it made any difference to things. I think discovering the transformational difference that believing in God made is really very, very important indeed. So how do we hold together science and faith? Let me quote from a Spanish philosopher, José Ortega, who wrote on this theme back in the 1940s, and I think his words are really, really very important. He makes the point that science is wonderful, something I would completely agree with, but it's also incomplete and inadequate. In other words, taken on its own, it doesn't answer some of the big questions you're going to ask. Notice what he says. Listen to this. See if you think he might be right. Scientific truth, he writes, is characterized by its precision and the certainty of its predictions. But these admirable qualities are achieved by science at the cost of remaining on the level of secondary concerns, leaving ultimate and decisive questions unanswered. And what he means by that is, look, science is just great when you're trying to work out the distance of the Earth from the Moon, the way in which the planets orbit around the suns, and many other things as well. But when you come to what he calls ultimate questions, he's borrowing that from Karl Popper, that means questions like, what is the point of life? What is good? And how do we live good lives? Is there a God? And he's simply saying, look, these really are questions that matter to us. And one of the questions you have to think about is whether science is able to answer these. Now, as a younger man, I thought science could, but I have to tell you that the more I've thought about this, I don't think it can. And in many ways, the view I've come to is the view you find in the writings of Peter Medawar. You probably know him, the Nobel Prize-winning biologist who worked at Oxford here in the 1960s. And in a book called The Limits of Science, he simply said, look, there are questions that science cannot answer, and that no conceivable advance of science would empower it to answer. What are the questions that you have in mind? Why are we here? What's the point of life? And so on. And so Medawar just says, look, you need to supplement science with another way of looking at things, which in effect enriches and deepens what science is able to deliver. And that's a way of thinking that I personally found very helpful. The idea that science and faith, in effect, if you like, illuminate different areas of life. Now, of course, there is overlap, but there is also distinctiveness, which I think needs to be respected. So we could approach this in a number of ways. But I think before I begin to move on and look at just ways of thinking about this that you might find helpful, I do need to just make the point that there are some scientists who would say that science is able to answer all of life's deepest questions. And I'm not sure that's right. There's a very interesting blog by Timothy Williamson, who's professor of logic here at Oxford, and he's challenging an American writer who in fact said, look, science can answer all the big questions of life, and we don't need philosophy or anything like that. And Williamson, I think, quite rightly said, look, we do need philosophy. We need to be able to open up these really deep questions. And anyway, there is a flaw in this argument that science is able to answer all the big questions of life. Because if that is true, then science itself must be able to show that science is able to answer all the big questions of life. And you can look up that blog very, very easily, and you'll see the point he's trying to make. Let's just go with the approach I'm exploring, and we'll see where it takes us and see whether you think this actually helps us to make sense of things. What I'm saying to you is that science looks at one aspect of life, faith looks at another. Sure, there are overlaps. We'll come to those. But I'm going to introduce you to one way of thinking that we find in the writings of a philosopher called Mary Midgley. Midgley studied philosophy here at Somerville many years ago. She's now quite old, but she's still active and writing. And her point, which she makes consistently in her writings over the last 10 years, is this, that a single map of reality is not going to be good enough. We need multiple maps if we're going to deal with the complexity of life. And she doesn't believe in God, but she's very, very clear. If you do believe in God, that's a very important part of the picture. Here's what she says. She says, look, it's a bit like looking into an aquarium. She says, we cannot see it as a whole from above, so we peer in at it through a number of small windows. And we can eventually make quite a lot of sense of this if we patiently put together the data from different angles. But if we insist that our own window is the only one worth looking through, we shan't get very far. And it's a helpful approach. What Midgley is saying is, look, science has its own tradition of investigation. It has its own way of looking at things, and that's great. But that approach means you see some things and you don't see others. Faith also has its angle of approach. And it's not going to tell you how distant the Earth is from the Moon, but it is going to open up those deep questions about who we are, what the meaning of life is, what value really matters, and so on. And that's not inconsistent with science. It rather is something that needs to be set alongside it. And that, I think, brings us to another way of thinking about this, which is different levels of approach. I've used this idea of different maps. You may find that helpful. Different levels is another way of thinking about this, and I think you may find this really quite helpful. It's simply saying, look, there are different levels at which we can engage reality, at which we can engage life, at which we can give answers to questions. I'm going to give you a very famous example, which was developed by a geologist called Frank Rhodes, who went on to become president of Cornell University in the States in the 1990s. And he gave this lovely example from his days as a student in the United Kingdom, which involves putting a kettle on a gas ring, yes, a gas ring, and watching it boil. And he says, look, let's ask this question. Why is the kettle boiling? And he says, well, look, there's one answer, which is, look, the gas is burning. That generates heat. It brings water to the boil. End of discussion. Except it's not. That's true, and it's part of the explanation, but it's only part of the explanation. Because, well, he then says, well, look, why is the kettle boiling? Well, because I wanted to make myself a cup of tea. Now, I mean, it's a beautiful little story, and you can almost imagine him huddled over his gas ring, making himself a cup of tea. But listen to what he says, and I think you'll see the point very, very clearly. These are different answers, but both are true. Both are complementary and not competitive. One answer is appropriate within a particular frame of reference, the other within another frame of reference. There's a sense in which each is incomplete without the other. So just to make sure you've got the point he's making, you know, it's not as if you have to say, well, it's either gas burning or wanting to make a cup of tea. He's saying they're both part of the picture. And go back to that quote I gave you from C.S. Lewis. It's really about trying to have this richest possible picture so we can look at things and see it most fully. In other words, getting the most out of it. And we all have our blind spots. And one of the difficulties, I think, is there are scientists who would say, well, of course, whatever science can tell me is right. Beyond science, no, we can't know anything. So I'm just going to draw a line and say anything outside science simply cannot be known. But I want to suggest to you that actually is quite an inadequate, quite an impoverished way of looking at things, and above all, it's not one that actually is justified. And I want to try and explore this by opening up a question which I think many of you will expect me to talk about, and rightly so, which is the whole question of faith and proof in both science and in matters of faith. So let's think about that. I think most of us would agree that one of the key themes in life is that we want to believe things that are trustworthy, that are reliable. And I want to, you know, reinforce that. It's an extremely important point. I dislike people who say, well, I think this, and therefore, you know, that's right. You know, I want to know for what reasons you think that might be right. And so this opens up this very important question of why we think certain things might be true. And most of you will know something about the kind of philosophical context against which this discussion is set. Back in the 17th century, there's this massive shift in thought in the West. People like Descartes, Spinoza, in effect urging us to say, look, you only trust what can be proved. which is why both Descartes and Spinoza place so much emphasis on logic and on mathematics. These prove their theorems, their beliefs, and therefore that's something we ought to apply to all of life. You only believe what you can prove. Now, that's very robust, you know, and I'd want to say, look, something can be proved, that's really good to know. But what about grey areas? Now, as you will all know, I think, postmodern philosophy has just said, look, we understand where these guys were coming from in the 17th century, and we can agree with them that their aspirations were right. But reality just isn't like that. It's much more complicated than that. And so you'll find that postmodern writers, I'm thinking of people like Heidegger, Wittgenstein, and perhaps Habermas, all will argue that it's not a question of being able to prove all our beliefs. It's rather saying, have we good reasons for thinking this might be right? And they talk about philosophy being fiduciary, a Latin word meaning something we take on trust. And what they are arguing is that philosophy rests on commitments whose truth we have to assume and which we cannot demonstrate. Now, those of you who are philosophers will know all about this, but the point I'm trying to make is that we have moved away from this idea of being able to prove everything and realizing that actually, in real life, there are an awful lot of things that matter profoundly that we think we are right in believing, but we can't absolutely prove to be true. And that isn't a problem. That's just the way we are as human beings. We're in a world where we cannot actually prove some of the things that matter most to us. And many of you will know the quote from Terry Eagleton, the cultural critic. He once wrote, "We hold many beliefs that have no unimpeachably rational justification, but are nevertheless reasonable to entertain." Now, I think is important. You know, if you think about this, you know, we could prove, I think, without undue difficulty that 2 and 2 make 4. But when you start getting to things like democracy is better than fascism, that rape is wrong, you know, you're in a different place. These are things, beliefs that matter to most of us profoundly. But if you were to challenge someone like me who believes both of those things and say, prove it, I just have to say to you, look, I can't, but I still think I'm right, and I've got some very good reasons for thinking that this is the case. Now, that's an extremely important point. Isaiah Berlin, as you probably know, was a very famous historian of ideas and philosopher here at Oxford until his death about 15 years ago. And Berlin just said, look, if we take all the beliefs that people hold, you can put them in 3 broad categories. Things you can prove by logic, things you can prove by science, and things you can't prove in either of those ways. And Berlin's point was simply this. The things that really matter to us, your political beliefs, your social beliefs, your ethics, your religion, all come in that 3rd category. It doesn't matter whether you're religious or not. You'll find yourself believing things that actually you cannot prove to be true, but nevertheless, you think you have very good reason in believing. And that, I think, is a very important point. Richard Dawkins, in his book, The Selfish Gene, says, look, you know, there's no need for faith in science. Science just proves, you know, its basic ideas. And, you know, I'm sympathetic to what he is saying, but I think it is rather more complicated than that. That actually in science, very often you're faced with evidence that is open to multiple interpretations. And those of your scientists can think of loads of examples of this. For example, you might think of the big debate over cosmology. Is there just one universe, or are there lots of universes, a kind of multiverse? And as you all know, I think that there are some reasons for thinking one might be right or the other, and the jury's out. And you will find very prominent scientists here in Oxford and elsewhere, you know, in effect saying, well, we think this one's right, or we think this one's right. but being aware that the evidence isn't absolutely conclusive and that those who take the opposing view are not fools. It's simply that the evidence is open to multiple interpretations. Why am I saying this? I'm simply saying we need to avoid very simplistic applications of science which say, look, you only trust what you can prove. If you only remember one thing from tonight's lecture, let it be this. You can only prove shallow truths. That the deep truths that actually give life meaning, that in effect speak to us about who we are, why we matter, what life is all about, actually lie beyond absolute proof. But they're not irrational. It's just that reason is unable to deliver the proof that we might hope for. And we cannot imprison ourselves inside a kind of rationalist worldview which says you only accept things you can absolutely prove. Faith isn't, you know, running away from reason. It's not abandoning reason. It's simply being able to say, look, I can't prove this, but there are very good reasons for thinking that this is right. So I want to emphasize that faith is not about running away from reality. If anything, it's about embracing a deeper way of thinking about things that helps us to realize that there is more to life than what can be disclosed by, for example, the sciences or indeed anything else. So let's look at some themes which I think are really important. Let's begin by looking at this question. There's something which really brings home to us that some of the deepest questions we face are really existential questions. Let me try and explain what I mean by that. It's about these deep issues, who we are, what really matters. And if I may, I'd like to go back to my own time as an atheist. When I was about 16 or 17, you know, I used to lie on my bed at night. I'd look out through the window, and I'd be able to see the stars in the night sky. I mean, the Belt of Orion, for example, some very bright stars. Some of you will know all about them. And as I looked at them, I knew enough about science to, in effect, recognize that those stars were so far away that it would be hundreds of years before the light being emitted from them arrived at Earth. And I'm sure you've all thought of this. When you look at a star in the sky, actually you're traveling backwards in time because you're seeing something that began its journey years and years ago. And for me, I find that a very melancholy thought. Why? Well, I think the main reason was this. Because my thought was, well, you know, the light that's leaving those stars right now won't arrive at Earth for hundreds of years, and by that time, I'll be dead. And so, you know, the night sky in many ways became for me a symbol of the mortality of humanity, the brevity of life. And of course, as an atheist at that time, so it also, I think, was a symbol of pointlessness. What is the point? You're born, you die, I mean, and it was a very, very unsettling thought for me. And I have to say that really there were others who shared that position. Peter Atkins, for example, who's a physical chemist based here in Oxford, talks about the universe as a machine which is, I quote, driven by motiveless, purposeless decay. And you can see where he's coming from. He's saying, look, you know, just get used to it. There's no point to life. The universe is going nowhere. Just grow up and accept it. And certainly, as a young atheist, you know, I believe something very similar to that. And I think I felt, because it's right, I ought to believe it. But I also felt this deep sense of unease. You know, this is not very comfortable. This doesn't actually really engage some of the deepest questions I'm asking. But I said to myself, look, if it's right, that's the way it is. Get used to it. But coming to Oxford, I think, really challenged me about this. I think made me realize that actually the evidential basis for that wasn't as good as I had thought. But for many, thinking about the night sky is still very, very unsettling. Here's Ursula Goodenough, who's an atheist biologist from the University of Washington. And she talks about being, I quote, overwhelmed with terror at the thought of the immensity of the universe and the fact that one day it was going to come to an end. Let me just read to her what she says. The night sky was ruined. I was realizing the universe is dying. I would never be able to look at it again. I wept into my pillow, long, slow tears of adolescent despair. A bleak emptiness overtook me whenever I thought about what was really going on out in the cosmos or deep in the atom. So I did my best not to think about such things at all. And you can understand that. She finds these very unsettling thoughts. But on the other hand, you wonder, can you live with those kind of unresolved questions? When I became a Christian, I saw things in a very different way. Let me just read you a few words from Psalm 8. And I think many of you will know these words very, very well. It's about who we are and our place in this universe. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you have established, what are human beings that you are mindful of them, mortals that you care for them? They're very wonderful words. They're simply saying, look, this is a vast universe. And maybe we do feel a little overwhelmed by it. But the one who made those things is someone who loves us, who knows us, and that changes everything. I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, my Christian faith doesn't just affect the way in which I think. It also affects the way in which I feel. Because it means, you know I'm not on my own in this world, that there is this deep relationship with the God who made us in the first place. And that, I think, is really very important indeed. But it also takes us off in some very important other directions. Let me mention, if I may, a few of those. One of them is this. Richard Dawkins takes the view that if you believe in God, you have a kind of impoverished view of the natural world. That somehow you look at the world and you see it in a much less exciting way than if you did not believe in God. Now, I think the evidence for that is actually slight, or in fact, if anything, non-existent. But I think he raises a very important question, which is, what is the difference that faith makes to the way in which you see the world? And I find that to be a very important consideration. Let me tell you what I think and see if this makes sense to you. I go back, let's take another psalm. I've mentioned Psalm 8, which is a great psalm to read. Think of Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of the Lord. Why does that speak so powerfully to me? Well, here's what it says to me, and let me see if this speaks to you as well. It's saying, look, I look at the beauty of nature, the night sky, a beautiful sunset, something like that. And I think that is just so wonderful. And it makes me want to engage with it, try and find out more about it. That's one of the reasons why I think I was drawn to science, because it allowed me to investigate the world even more closely. But here's the thing. If you believe in God, it's not simply just investigating the world. It's about also appreciating the wisdom and the beauty of God. You know, just like, you know, if you're an art historian, you look at the picture they paint, and then you begin to think, I wish I could know the artist to understand what's gone into that, what it's like. That, in effect, the work of art points to the artist. And there's a very deep sense that if you look at the world through a God-shaped lens, which is what I do now, in effect, it makes you want to love the world. It's all about environmental protection, but also to find out more about it, because in doing that, you're finding out more about God. And indeed, many of you will know, if you go back to the early scientific revolution of the late 15th, early 16th century, one of the big motivations for that was this feeling that to embrace, to discover more about nature is also to discover more about God. And that's certainly the way I feel, that my faith in God really motivates me to want to know more about nature, partly because that's interesting in itself, but also because it enhances and enriches my understanding of God. But let's look at one question that many of you tonight may be thinking. And it's a phrase I'm going to use that probably most of you will be familiar with. The God of the gaps. What is that? And is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? People sometimes use the phrase, the God of the gaps. And they mean by it something like this. One of the reasons why I believe in God is there are certain things that science cannot explain. And therefore, in effect, God is about the scientifically inexplicable. And I want to say, I am actually sympathetic to that. I don't think science does explain everything. But for me, as for so many other scientists, it's not looking for God in gaps. It's about standing back and appreciating this big picture of reality that Christianity gives. It's not the gaps, it's the big picture that really give us this compelling view of what faith is all about. As I told you earlier, you know, I became a Christian in 1971, which I know is a very long time ago, when I was an undergraduate at Wadham. And one of the dons at Wadham was a man called Charles Colson, who was then Oxford's first professor of theoretical chemistry. And he was a Methodist lay preacher. And I heard him preach on several occasions. I talked to him. And he simply said, look, don't look for God in gaps. What kind of God's that? Appreciate that Christianity gives you this lens, this framework for making sense of things. That's what it's all about. And I want to encourage you to think in very similar terms. Not about gaps, but about this rich vision of reality that the Christian faith makes possible. So I mentioned that there were some issues that, you know, we could talk about in more detail. And clearly the rise of the movement that we sometimes call the New Atheism, I think, is very important in this respect. And so while it might be interesting just to raise a few issues that the New Atheism has raised, just to explore them and see where they take us. And the New Atheism, I think, is very interesting in many ways. It's saying, look, science basically impels you towards atheism. That if you are a scientist, you cannot be a religious believer, because science is simply saying, look, God is simply eliminated by science. There is no reason for that at all. Science is right, faith is wrong. And many of you will have read works by perhaps Richard Dawkins, which make that point. I want to, you know, say a number of things. One of them is that, you know, he does raise some very good questions. I think he's entirely right to do so, but I have to say I'm not really persuaded by the answer that he gives. Let me just mention a number of things that I think need to come into our conversation. One of them is this, and this, I think, is very important. Science is about trying to give us the best explanation of the evidence that we have. And as you know, evidence accumulates over time. And the result is that what scientists of a previous generation believed may be abandoned by another generation. So let's just go back to 100 years earlier, 1915. There weren't actually many students at Oxford in 1915. Most of them were away fighting in the First World War. But if there had been a lecture here in Oxford in 1915 on contemporary understandings of the universe, then in effect, this is what would have been said. The universe has always been here. There's no question of it changing. All that happens is maybe energy migrates from one end to another. But the universe is eternal. It's always been here. It's always going to be here. And a number of writers, the Danish writer Arrhenius, for example, who simply said, this is the way the universe actually is. This is what modern science tells us. You and I, meeting here today, 100 years later, would know that that answer is no longer regarded as being right. In effect, we now think in terms of the universe coming into existence in what we call the Big Bang, and it means now we have to speak about the universe having an origin. And one of the points I want to make is this. It suddenly gives a new intensity, a new plausibility to Christian language about creation. Now, let me make it clear, scientific language about origination, religious language about creation, they're not exactly the same. But you can see there's a clear convergence between them. And it's a very interesting example of science, first of all, changing its mind, and secondly, changing its mind in a direction that actually is surprisingly consistent with what Christian faith is all about. Some of you may know about the very famous debate of 1948. It was called the God question, and it pitted Bertrand Russell, the atheist, against Frederick Cobbleton, a Christian, to talk about the whole question of whether there's a God, and if there is a God, what difference does it make? And so they looked at a whole range of questions. One of them was, you know, do we need God to have a stable morality? And Cobbleton won that particular debate. But one of the questions was, do we need God to explain the universe? And Russell won that debate because he simply said, look, we all agree the universe has always been here. It doesn't need explaining. It just is. End of discussion. But that's not what we think today. And you may know that there's a very famous replay of that debate in 1998. William Lane Craig on the Christian side and Anthony Flew, the philosopher, on the atheist side. And in effect, William Lane Craig said, look, either you have to say the universe came into existence by a process we just don't understand and never will understand, or you have to say the Christian explanation of God actually makes a lot of sense. And Anthony Flew found it very difficult to actually deal with that. And you probably know he moved away from atheism as a result of that debate. So the point I want to make to you is this. Look, people very often say science and faith are in conflict. Well, I want to say to you that there are times, I'm sure, when they are. But very often those are overstated. And very often it's, in effect, a failure to realize that science is on a journey. This is where it is today. It may be somewhere quite different tomorrow. And the historical example I've given you, I think, just makes it very, very clear that we need to be careful about saying, in effect, that science and religion are in conflict. Because very often that may be the way it seems, but it might not be in the longer term. But let me tell you something about C.S. Lewis. You'll say, why? Well, I think the answer is because I quite like C.S. Lewis, and he's an Oxford man, so why not? But interestingly, Lewis was an atheist who became a Christian. And he wrote about what it was that made him change his mind. And some of those questions are very, very interesting. He said, look, I thought atheism was kind of probably right, but it was terribly dull. You know, it didn't really appeal to his imagination. There was something clearly missing. It did not have existential traction, if I could use a word that might help you there. But Lewis talks about his conversion in an unpublished document dating from 1930. And he says this, I am an empirical theist. I came to faith in God through induction. What does he mean by that? What he means is what, you know, most of you scientists here tonight will just think of as being second nature, that you check out a theory by how well it accommodates experience and observation. Here's the theory, there's what's observed, how well does the theory map onto observations? And Lewis's discovery was simply that Christianity gave him a better way of making sense of things than his former atheism. I want to kind of wrap this lecture up now and give us plenty of time to talk about anything else you'd like to. But here are the points I really want to make in closing. Number one, when I moved from atheism to Christianity, it wasn't really about moving away from fact to faith. I know it's sometimes hard to present it, but it's not really. It's very much about moving from one faith to another faith. Does that surprise you? See, atheism actually is a faith. You know, my atheist friends, as I once believed myself, would say, look, we believe there is no God, and in brackets, but we can't actually prove that. I believe very passionately now that there is a God, and I would have to put in brackets afterwards, I cannot prove that's true, although I believe very, very strongly it's right, it makes an awful lot of sense of things, and it changes things utterly. But they're both faith positions. And remember that point I made earlier, quoting Isaiah Berlin? You look, all the big questions of life, you know, what your political views are, what your social views are, what your ethics are, what your religious views are, even if they are anti-religious, in the end, they're all matters of faith that are very difficult to prove, if they can be proven at all, which is very unlikely. And that's just the way we are. And so what I'm saying to you is, the question is not, can belief in God be proved? Look at it this way. It's much more. Look, let's just take God as a kind of theory. You know, does that seem to make more sense of what we experience within us, what we observe around us? And my answer is, yes, it does. There's no way that I saw my transition from atheism to Christianity as being a kind of leap of faith in the dark, kind of way just saying, oh, you know, there's no evidence for this, I'm just going to, you know, hope for the best. It's much more a realization that there is this way of looking at things, which, if it is right, then it changes everything. And that's why I find that quote from C.S. Lewis so helpful. I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen. Not just because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. My final point. What Lewis is really saying is that the Christian faith is like a lens. It brings things into focus. Some of you have read Richard Dawkins and know his book, River Out of Eden. And in that book, he in effect says something like this. The universe we observe is exactly what we'd expect if there is a bottom, no good, no evil, no meaning, no purpose, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. What I want to suggest to you is that maybe Dawkins is using a lens to look at life which isn't in focus. And there are other lenses which might give you a crisper and clearer view of what things are all about. And what Lewis really is saying is, and I would echo this from my own experience, is that Christianity gives you this way of seeing things, which illuminates the shadowland, let you see further and more clearly than you otherwise would. And sure, there are always going to be things that are a little bit opaque and in the shadows, but you see more clearly and more further than otherwise would be the case. As Warren Roberts would want to say, and rightly so, there's an awful lot more to Christianity than that. But that's a part that's really quite important to me as a scientist who became a theologian. I'm sure it's important to many of you here tonight. And for me, Christianity gives you that way of seeing things, which doesn't just make sense, but lets you see the world, yourself, everything, in a completely different way. And it just seems to me very exciting. I look back to the time when I embraced that as being really the moment when life really began. A lot more I could say, but I think it's very important to stop and give you plenty of time for questions, and I'm very happy now to hand over to you. Thank you so much for listening.
Many, many thanks to Professor McGrath. As he said, there's an opportunity now for questions, so just put a hand up and we will try and make sure that a microphone comes to where you sit. So, first question, just over here, Luna. Thank you.
Good evening, sir. Thank you very much for your wonderful talk. My question, I'm sorry if it addresses one of those gaps that you were talking about, but it would be, if we believe that the God of the Bible is the Creator, and He's the one who's made us in His image, and He knows us from while we were still in our mother's womb, then why is there defects in children when they are born? Or why is this unfairness present? Is he just an experimentalist who hasn't been able to standardize the process and some results come out good and the others aren't?
Thank you. Well, yeah, that's a very good question. And you may, in fact, know that I think it was some young person asked the Pope that question in Rome recently. And I think he really gave what I thought was a very good answer, just saying, look, you know, this is not the way God wants things to be, but things very often work out like this. And it's not as if God is kind of way, you know, jiggling the knobs so everything turns out absolutely perfectly. Maybe this is the way the world has to be if there's going to be life in it in the first place. I think we very often forget, you know, how if I can put it, fragile a thing life is. In order for us to come into being, there are all these kind of things that need to be there in the world to make it so. And I often ask myself a very similar question. You know, I mean, it sounds very arrogant, I know, but I would often say, well, look, you know, if I were God, surely we could get a world where there's no suffering, no pain, where the kind of things you've rightly described, you know, are not happening. And that's where my heart takes me. You know, I really empathize with your question. And yet deep down there's this question, you know, is it really that simple? You know, perhaps we just have to recognize that the way the world is, these things do happen. And I don't think that that's in any way challenging God's goodness, because in many ways one of the themes we find in the Christian Bible is that the world has gone wrong. That's one of the things. These things happen, that the way the world is not the way it's meant to be. And you have this wonderful account in the Bible of God choosing to come into the world and actually experience suffering, experience rejection, you know, experience death. In effect, if you like, entering into the creation and taking this on himself. So I share your puzzlement, I share your concern, all those things. And yet, you know, the Bible speaks to us of a tender God who weeps with his children as they suffer. It's a very moving picture of God. And actually, you know, I find that very helpful in those situations, even though, you know, they do leave me with intellectual questions. Now, you're probably maybe thinking of, you know, Stephen Fry's recent outburst in Dublin. And I have to say, look, if you're an atheist, I mean, like Fry is, you know, okay, you say God's horrible for allowing these things to happen. Does that stop those things happening? No, it doesn't. The atheist hasn't got an answer to these questions. And that's one of the things I think it's very important to realize. Very often, you know, these deep questions are thrown up, and we rightly say, look, maybe the Christian faith, you know, gives us answers which seem to us not to be, you know, absolutely convincing. And then we look at the alternatives that are on offer. You know, this is just the way things are. Tough, get used to it. And actually, I just don't find that a very good answer. I think this biblical image of a tender, loving God who, in effect, weeps over the way the creation is and tries to restore it and renew it through the death and resurrection of Christ. I need to give a much longer answer, but that's the beginnings of the answer I would give. So thank you very much for asking that question.
Thank you. Another hand just in the middle here.
Thank you very much for your talk. From ancient Greece to the present day, there are plenty of scientists who, in their unconscious life, in their subconscious, they believe in God. They do not deny the sense of order of a creator might be hidden there somewhere. They don't have the courage to speak it up as a scientist. I believe in God because it doesn't. I think the conflict between scientists and theologians nowadays is people do not believe in God because they don't want the freedom of God or the freedom that the religion provides. And science needs full freedom until destruction of the world with the nuclear and so on. So I think the problem of freedom is something that keeps...
Could you just put a question if we wouldn't...
Yeah. It's something that... The question of freedom is something that scientists will never accept from the part of God or Christianity. And the second question would be, you spoke about Christianity as being a world full of visible things and certainties and so on, but Christianity is, as I see it, full of doubts, and faith is never true faith if it does not go through the holes and gaps.
Thank you. There's a lot in that, so I'll try and tease out some of the points you made and take them further. First of all, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there are many scientists who, in effect, you know, are religious believers because it's just the most obvious way of explaining things. It makes perfect sense to them. It makes sense of what they observe. It makes sense of their capacity to make sense of the world. And certainly, I've had many conversations with scientists here in Oxford, and they keep making this point. One of my friends is quite an aggressive atheist. But, I mean, he said to me once, look, you know, the fact that we can make sense of this universe is just a bloody miracle. Actually, you know I'm not a religious man, but you know that there's something odd going on there. You know, and I thought that was really interesting. He was this very honest atheist scientist saying, look, there's something funny about things, and I don't want to go that way, but I can see why an awful lot of people do, and it's very, very interesting to me. But you're right also, I think, to flag up one of the issues, which is that the scientists just love pursuing things wherever they take them. And so that they get annoyed at people who stand in their way. I think one of the questions that this raises is it's not just about freedom, it's about ethics and goodness. And one of the many paradoxes we face is this, is actually that science is morally blind. And it's a very, very big issue. It's very, very controversial. Some friends of mine went to see a play about Oppenheimer recently. Oppenheimer, remember, is the father of the atomic bomb. And you know, they came away with this very, very deep anxiety. Look, you know, science can't tell us what is good, but we need some concept of goodness to be able to look at some of the things that are happening, like, for example, dropping the atomic bomb in Japan and so on. And so I think, you know, it's just one of these fascinating questions, which is that for most of us here tonight, the question of what good is, are we leading a good life, is really important. And science actually isn't going to help us to get to the answer there. And that's one of the reasons why I think Christianity is so important. It actually begins to give us a framework to answer questions like goodness, what good life is, and how actually we're able to embrace that good life, not on our own strength, but also in God's strength. So there's a lot of very good things come out of your questions. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you. We'll just go around the back and then towards the front.
Professor McGrath, thank you so much for your talk. I appreciate it. My question concerns one of natural theology. You referenced Psalm 19, which we know in the first part juxtaposes general revelation, the second part special revelation. To what extent can we use science to know God? What can we know about God through science? And then I guess the second question, but still part of it, is how do you know that that's all we can know about God? So what's your source for it? Do we just quote Romans 1, Psalm 19, or what's your source for that?
Yes, that's a very good question. Let me begin to answer it. I think I quote Psalm 19. I really like that, you know, that the heavens declare the glory of the Lord. But, you know, it wasn't as if the people of Israel sort of were walking out one day and looked at the heavens and said, oh, my goodness, there's a God. You know, they already knew that. What they did was they looked at the world around them, and they saw that as an imaginative amplification, if you like, of their understanding of God. In other words, it wasn't just, you know, we know there's a God. It's look what that God has done. Isn't that wonderful? That enriches our vision of God. I think that's quite an important point to make. I personally wouldn't say that you can argue your way to God by looking at the natural world. But I think what you can say is, if you kind of look at the world through a Christian lens, it resonates very, very strongly. I think that's very important. So I think, you know, what you've talked about natural theology, you know, the ability of nature somehow to point to God, is a very interesting question. And of course, as I'm sure you know, Christian theologians do disagree about this, but I'll gladly tell you what I think and just see what you make of it. It seems to me that what Christianity does is giving you a new way of looking at the natural world. And you know, just to make this point absolutely clearly, you can look at something and yet you don't fully understand what you're seeing. You know, that's a very important point. What Christianity does is enable you to see things in a way that brings added depth. So, to give you an example, you know, my atheist friends look at nature and we're all looking at the same thing. They see meaningless, random happenings. It's all very, very negative. I see something else because I'm looking at it through a God lens. But let's look at it from a number of perspectives. Number one, Christianity says, look, this world is God's creation. It is. And we are the stewards of it. And therefore, in some way, we've got to look after this world properly. And it's a very important theme that in some way we have a responsibility for looking after the natural world. There's a kind of environmental ethic built into the Christian doctrine of creation. That seems to me to be, you know, a very important point to make. Secondly, and I tried to make this point a little bit in what I was saying, when I look at nature, I very often see things that actually take my breath away. That get, you know, it's like Wordsworth looking at the daffodils and getting really excited. And I do that too. I'm sure all of you have had that experience of seeing something you saw, oh, that was wonderful. What Christianity does is say, look, hold that thought in your mind. There's something even greater and more wonderful that that is pointing to. It's a harbinger, a sort of a pointer to something even better. Enjoy what there is. There's even better that's yet to come. Again, that seems to me to be very important indeed. But the third point I'd want to make is that actually it's a very important way of talking about God to people who don't really believe in God, but have a deep sense of the beauty of nature or the ordering of nature. And it's a way of opening up a dialogue about what this is all about. And one of the questions you're going to ask is, look, which of us has got a better lens to look at nature? Which of us actually sees more detail, if I can put it very, very crudely? And as I was saying earlier, one of the things that drew me to faith is this realization that Christianity gives you a way of looking at the natural world, which affirms everything that the scientists are saying, but denies the scientists' ultimacy in this. There's more to life, more to the world than science can disclose. And it's that added value, that enrichment, which really speaks to me as being something that's very important indeed. So I think the simplest answer to give to your question is that for me, as a Christian, it's not that nature proves there's a God or anything like that, but rather my Christian faith gives me, to use that wonderful phrase in, I think it's Ephesians 1, the eyes of your heart kind of way enable you to see this in a way that affects your head and heart, and actually gives me a way of not just seeing the world, but living within it responsibly and meaningfully. All I'm saying is Christianity is not a set of ideas. You say, oh, that's right, tick, 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 tick. It's much more, it gives you a moral, intellectual, spiritual framework which allows you to live rich lives, fulfilled lives in this world. And that to me has become very important. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Another one just nearby.
Thank you very much for the talk. Really enjoyed it. You've mentioned a few points that, you know, there are questions that science can't answer, which I agree with, but you've pulled out, you know, what is good as an example of this, and maybe in the strictest sense of science, not, but could you speak to the broader debate in terms of reason and ethics? I mean, certainly the utilitarian argument that, you know, reason and logic can lead us to what is good apart from faith.
I think it's a very interesting question, and as you all know, there's a massive debate about this, and it's very hard for me to kind of way synopsize it simply. But what I'd want to say is that, A, this question of what good is very, very important. And you may have read Sam Harris's book, The Moral Landscape, where he tries to argue that actually science can deliver morality. But he does so, I'm afraid, by ignoring all the obvious reasons why it can't. So it's not really very satisfying. But here's what I want to say, which in effect answers your question, but sets it in a deeper context. There's a very famous book by Roy Baumeister, who's a social psychologist, and it's called The Meanings of Life. And he doesn't answer the question, what's the meaning of life? He says, look, here is what any theory of the meaning of life has to deal with. If it doesn't deal with this, it doesn't work, it's no good. He says, look, you have to talk about identity. Who are we? I have to talk about value. You know, do we really matter? What use are we? We need to talk about this whole question of values. Not just, am I valued, but what values do I live by? And then finally, can I make a difference? Question of agency. And Baumeister just says, look, those are really deep questions. We haven't got answers to those. We're in trouble, really, because we just drift. And what I want to say is, you see morality is in the mix, but also other things as well. And all of these are non-empirical qualities, meaning, agency, you know, value, identity. And what is so wonderful about Christianity is it gives you this framework which actually answers those questions. It engages them realistically, robustly, and gives you good answers. Okay, it can't prove they're right, but actually you just have this deep sense, this is so good and makes so much sense that actually I can live with this. And of course, you know, you can give very good reasons for saying it's right as well. So I think what I'm saying to you is two things, really. One is that I think you're absolutely right to raise questions about you know, science and morality, and that can be extended to other things as well. But here, I think, is the really important point. Think of those questions again, you know, morality, value, identity. In the end, the answers you give to those questions are important, but you cannot prove they are right. And it doesn't matter whether you're religious or anti-religious. That's just the way we are as human beings. We just are unable to actually prove these things to be true. But deep within us is this hunch, this is right. And that's what Paul, I think, is getting at Romans 1. You know, it's not just a revelation of the gospel. There's something almost implanted within us which makes us think this is something deeply profound and right here. And what Christianity does is to reinforce those beliefs, rightly, but then give us more. It's not just about sort of validating what nature might say to us. It's about, in effect, giving us an extended, richer, deeper vision which builds on that. And that, for me, is just what's so exciting. It's hinted at that in nature. It's much more fully disclosed in the gospel itself. Thank you.
Thank you. There's another one towards the front here.
I'm trying to do a little bit simplified. The God always said he never rejected man to have build the knowledge. It's knowledge, it's part of the human current. But God always said, the wisdom you're not going to have. And this is my, I would like to see your explanation about wisdom. And the second, I always look in the faith from the heart and the reasoning and the knowledge come from the brain. And two things, this is always the problem with the scientists. They always try to, that is a kind of, they always think they're going to be overshadowed from one part to another part. And how you see, as a humankind, to heart and brain work together?
Thank you. Well, I think that's a very good question. I may not have understood completely, so do forgive me if I don't quite get it right, but I think there are two very important points being made here. One is, you drew this distinction between knowledge and wisdom. I think that's so important. We live in a kind of age of information. All this stuff we've got on the web and everywhere else. And yet for many people, the really unsettling, disturbing thing is, they can't make sense of it. You know, they're overwhelmed by knowledge, but they haven't got a sense of meaning. There's no wisdom in it at all. I think that for me is a very important thing, that actually it's about, if you like, we're being bombarded with threads, and we need to be able to weave those threads together into a pattern. And that for me is one of the wonderful things about Christianity. It weaves these things together. It's that idea I find in Colossians chapter 1, where Paul talks about all things cohering or being connected together in Christ. And that to me is very important. It's saying, in effect, you need to stand back and try and see the deeper picture, which is not just more and more information, but actually is something deeper and richer that helps you make sense of that, but actually goes beyond it. So use the dialectic between knowledge and wisdom, which I like. I think it's a very good thing. And for me, you know, Christianity does give us this sense of wisdom of, that is something that helps us to make sense of all the things that we see around us. And secondly, you made a very good point, again, you know, the head and the heart. And there is this real danger that we simply become so obsessed with facts that actually we nourish here and neglect here. And, you know, I think really, for me, going back to Roy Baumeister, I mentioned a moment ago, I mean, what he was saying is, look, you know, there are cognitive issues, there are existential issues, and actually you need a way of thinking that engages both. And you haven't got that. There's always going to be part of you that is going to be restless, dissatisfied. And again, for me, you know, Christianity really gives me a mental map, you know, a way of thinking, which is wonderful, but also speaks to me at a much deeper level. You know, it talks about love, it talks about significance, and these are at a different level. And it's not as if, kind of way, these are just bolted on as an add-on. They're an integral part of the picture. There's a very famous quote from Augustine of Hippo, a Christian writer of the 5th century, and he said, you know, it's a prayer, he said, "You have made us for yourself, and our heart is restless until it finds its rest in you. It's a beautiful phrase, and it's a bit like the prodigal son. You come home, and your heart, your deepest intuitions say, this is where I'm meant to be. Not more I need to say, but that will do us, I think, for there.
Thank you. Well, I think we'd better stop there. Thank you very much indeed, Professor McGrath. Let's give him a round of applause as we go. Just one or two things before you go. Do stay if you want a cup of tea or coffee. Do loiter and chat with one another. A couple of things to mention. First of all, there are a few books on a table in front of the bookstore. Other books are available as well. But particularly I want to mention Alistair's own book with his wife, Joanna Collicott McGrath, The Dawkins Delusion, engaging with Richard Dawkins, and a really fine book. Also two books by Professor John Lennox, another professor at this university, again, engaging with issues of science and faith. One in particular engaging with Stephen Hawking, of course, much in the news at the moment with the film that's just come out. If you're someone who's interested to engage a bit more in Christian faith and you're a member of the university, next week there's a series of meetings called Uncover. Tim Keller and Oz Guinness are going to be addressing all sorts of issues about Christian faith. Tim Keller in the evening looking at John's account of the life and teaching of Jesus Christ, Oz Guinness looking at some of the issues engaging in Christian thinking and behind Christian faith in the town hall, lunchtime and evenings. Do go along to that. Also on the table at the back is that Gospel of John, John's account of the life of Jesus, teaching Jesus. That is free. The other books there is a charge for. You've seen on the seats these little blue cards. If you're someone here who'd say, I'd love to find out a little bit more about what goes on here at St. Ev's Sunday services, or I'd be interested to join a group thinking through the basics of Christian faith. We have lots of opportunities here, and we'd love to help you. If that was you, just tick the box, and by either door, there's a little box that you could put this card in as you leave. Once again, do make the most of tea and coffee. I suspect Alison's not going immediately.
I have to dash.
He's dashing immediately, so you've missed your chance. But thank you for coming.